Chapter 3, Prevalent Objections. Are the theories of reincarnation and karma really true? Are these age-old doctrines founded upon fact? Such questions must be approached with a completely open mind, for prejudice is one of the greatest barriers to the attainment of knowledge. Is it not a curious fact that whilst from time immemorial, Oriental peoples have accepted reincarnation in one form or another as a basic and unchallengeable fact of life? Yet we of the West hesitate to assent. In order to facilitate unprejudiced examination of the doctrine of rebirth, I now consider some prevalent objections and offer an answer to each of them. The first objection is headed, Rebirth Not Desired. One of the commonest objections arising from a shrinking from life in the flesh and from the suffering which is the lot of man at this stage of human evolution is understandable. I don't want to come back here again, so many people say. Once is enough for me. One cannot but sympathize with those whose experience of life has been so unfortunate as to bring them to such a conclusion. Nevertheless, according to the doctrine of reincarnation, the objection is invalid, is misconceived. For by rebirth is not implied the return to earth of our present selves. We do not reincarnate. The personal self, with its bodily and mental characteristics, its name, race, creed, sex, and outlook, this person does not return. According to theosophy, at death, the temporary mortal body is finally laid aside to reappear no more. The same later being true of the bodies of emotion and of mind. I have a footnote there, friends, drawing attention to a lecture by Dr. Annie Besant called Death and After, and apparently by myself, The Mystery of Death. That which down here, then, we generally regard as ourselves is in reality not our true selves at all. That true self of man is an eternal, immortal, spiritual being, quite distinct from, even whilst occupying, the physical body. Being immortal and eternal, it does not, cannot die. The body, on the other hand, being but mortal, naturally passes away. Since it had a beginning, it must have an end. The spiritual self is permanent, everlasting. Never having had a beginning, it can never have an end. This all-important truth is beautifully expressed in Sir Edwin Arnold's poetic translation of the great Hindu scripture, the Bhagavad Gita. Never the spirit was born, the spirit shall cease to be never. Never was time it was not. End and beginning are dreams, birthless and deathless and changeless remaineth the spirit forever. Death hath not touched it at all, dead though the house of it seems. title of that wonderful poem, which I venture to recommend, The Song Celestial. According to the doctrine of reincarnation, it is the divine self, the immortal pilgrim God within the body which reincarnates, and not the mortal bodily man with his transient feelings and thoughts. When, therefore, we think and say, in objection to rebirth, I do not want to return, we need have no fear. We, as we normally know ourselves, do not return. It is the divine essence, the spiritual self, with its acquired individual attributes, which reincarnates. This one common objection thus disposed of, one difficulty is, I hope, cleared away. A further objection is based upon the possibility that reincarnation might imply transmigration of souls from human into animal forms. This is an entirely erroneous view of the doctrine, and consequently, as an objection, is invalid. When once the life in any form has attained to a certain level of unfoldment, although there may be delay or digression, there is no real retrogression. The idea that the process of descent into incarnation could be forced upon us by an external power against our will is also unacceptable to some minds. To this objection, the answer is made that the impulse to descend into a new baby body arises within the spiritual self, the reincarnating principle. The expansive pressure of the divine will, which is the power behind the whole process of evolution throughout the universe, is felt by the human monad ego, the spiritual self, as an interior resolve and not as an external resistless command. As there is but one divine will, one divine life, and one divine intelligence, a trinity in unity, throughout and within all nature and all men, the divine triplicity which constitutes the dweller in the innermost in man must be part of the one great divinity in all, and not separate in any way, therefore. In consequence of this basic and indissoluble unity, the impetus to self-expression in material forms for purposes of unfoldment, the thrust of spirit, is in no sense received externally by the spiritual self of man. Interior impulsion, and not external compulsion, initiates the process of incarnation in successive forms. There is but one spiritual will in the cosmos, and the will self of the monad of man is an embodiment thereof. Full recognition of this fact is the highest vision, and its ratification in action is the secret of well-being. Thus it is seen that the spiritual self of man voluntarily accepts the opportunity of achieving further evolutionary progress provided by the experiences of earthly life. Self-impelled, the monad ego of man sets forth upon its pilgrimage to perfection. Self-impelled also, it descends into each new physical form. The mind may also shrink from accepting the doctrine of reincarnation on the grounds that rebirth will so separate loved ones as to preclude all possibility of future reunion. This objection, in its turn, is invalid. Neither birth nor death, nor rebirth, can ever completely or finally separate those between whom a deep spiritual, intellectual, or physical bond has been formed. In their spiritual selves, wherein the closest affinity has been established, they are forever at one, whether physically embodied or disembodied. For in the state of consciousness in which the spiritual self of man abides, separation is impossible, parting unknown. Furthermore, the very fact of the existence of so close a bond will cause them repeatedly to descend into incarnation at about the same time, and under conditions in which they are likely to meet, being drawn together by their affinity and by the law of cause and effect. On meeting, although the new brain, the seat of memory, may not remember the incidents of past intimate associations, the heart speaks. A mutual attraction is felt, and love is renewed. Sometimes, indeed, at first sight. Again, a life relationship, differing in various incarnations, is established. This may be parental, filial, or, whether within or without the family, fraternal. In each new association, love deepens, grows more unselfish, more noble, until at last the state is reached of love perfected, which is life perfected, even after the human kingdom is left behind and the superhuman kingdom entered. There is evidence that the close association continues in that cooperation with the one will, which is characteristic of the life of the adept.